Rewind is an award-winning insider's look at Wisconsin politics and public policy. Brought to you by Wisconsin Eye and wispolitics.com. To become a program sponsor, please send an email to rewind@wiseye.org.
I believe united we stand, and we have common ground to find, and we're going to find it. We're not even sitting here.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is Rewind for the week after state government got a budget deal. But first, Wisai was there. Governor Tony Evers welcomes Nexus, which is going to build a major medical healthcare facility in East Wisconsin. A warning from Supreme Court Justice-elect Hagedorn. The director of the state lottery says maybe it's not a good idea to give lottery winners the option of not having their names made public. And finally, I asked two of my fellow Capitol reporters, what about the political arguments of Medicaid expansion? Wisai was there.
It is the first time in 30 years that a pharmaceutical company has built a new manufacturing facility for sterile injectables. Nexus uses innovative processes to make difficult to manufacture specialty drugs that are easier to use, less labor intensive, and more streamlined in practice. So this is going to obviously pay dividends for all of Wisconsin by creating jobs throughout the regions and also building the state's tax base. It shows how investments we make as a state yield private sector investments in our communities.
Although the advantage to winners of remaining anonymous is clearly apparent, the disadvantages to players, lotteries, and other stakeholders are less obvious. Winner transparency increases the odds that wrongdoers who commit lottery fraud will be caught. There have been instances where lottery insiders have committed fraud and were caught, at least in part, because the winners' names were known.
Sometimes you ever hear people say, well, this is really bad policy, it's really unfair, maybe it's bad for democracy, therefore it's unconstitutional. You ever hear that before? Something like that? That's not only wrong, that's dangerous. Particularly, by the way, if you hear judges say that, you should run for the hills.
Is that a pretty effective PR argument to say expand welfare?
When we're operating in an economy that many would argue is the best in decades, and I think people, when they hear the word welfare, are, you know, if you polled them, they probably wouldn't support it too much. So I think politically it's probably a smart move. Democrats, of course, would argue it's the farthest thing from welfare, and either way, they're still using this argument to turn down a ton of money, and it makes no fiscal sense.
There were no signs that that was ever going to be successful from the Republican side, but right. I think they see that healthcare issue was good for them in the 2018 race. I think they see that as a good issue for them in 2020. So they're keeping it alive and probably kept, you know, we're really hammering it during the budget cycle probably for that reason too.
Currently, healthcare professionals are eligible for loan assistance if they serve in rural or eligible practice areas. Assembly Bill 178 amends this definition of eligible practice area to include free and charitable clinics. The simple change will enable health professionals like physicians and dentists who serve in these clinics the same opportunity for loan assistance as those serving in rural and underserved areas.
We talked at length last week about the governor's 78 vetoes of the GOP budget. One of them drew a lot of attention this week. The change he made that raised state spending on K-12 school aids by, let me get that, $84 million, although there was a change that backed that off by 18. What is being called a write-up veto, and that prompted Senator David Craig and Representative Mike Kuglich to introduce a constitutional change to end write-up vetoes. Why?
Well, because he found a way around the restriction that governors have. They can't increase spending just by going in and saying, okay, if lawmakers approve $100 million for Project X, he can't cross out writing $200 million, right? But what he did was they put in language that says, about per pupil spending. So there are two kinds of aids that we have in the state. One is categorical aids, which is basically about property values. Property rich districts get less per pupil than property poor districts. Per pupil aid is a different pot of money where it's basically everybody should be the same. Per pupil, you get this much money per
kid. X amount, 200, right? 204, 200 year one, 204 year two.
So they've been increasing it all these years. Republicans wrote into the budget a way to increase that by $25 each year. What Evers did, though, was he took pieces of that sentence and crossed it out to move everything to a higher number for both years of the biennium.
Right.
Okay? Now, That is called a sum sufficient appropriation. What that means is whatever the set number is, whatever the appropriation is, you must spend the money to meet that requirement. Therefore, Department of Public Instruction has to spend the money to meet that new per pupil aid. That's how we got around it. Right. The thing is, I don't know how often that can be done in the budgets. Now, it also proves that, remember, we heard from Republicans when the budget was passed out of both houses that we're trying to veto-proof this document. You can't veto-proof a budget from a governor. It just can't be done. However, they did, you know, restrict how many probably could do by taking some language out. Here's an example, though, where he found a way around that whole restriction of you can't raise spending by doing this. Again, how often you do that, I don't know.
And after the governor acted on his budget, you went to the the press conference with Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald and said he can do this. But then Senator Craig and Representative Kugler said, we need to prevent this from ever happening again. It is beyond time we right-size the governor's veto pen to protect taxpayers. Now, let's talk about how this would work. If the Republicans pass this in this session and have to be approved again in the next session before it could go to voters, no sooner than 2021, 2022.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it passes back-to-back sessions, so you could pass it in this session, which is 19-20. Mm-hmm. Next one, 21-22. Pass it there, go to a statewide referendum. If you passed it early in 21, spring election 21, it could be on the ballot, possibly.
Is this a priority with Speaker Voss and Majority Leader Fitzgerald?
I don't know, leadership has a chance to talk their caucus yet to figure it out. And that's the thing. Like, I mean, this came out of kind of, I'll say left field, but, you know, it was introduced quickly. They haven't had a chance to caucus because both legislature or houses, both caucuses have split.
Gone for the summer.
Yep. The building is emptied out. They haven't a chance to talk to everybody, figure out where they're at. The questions I have are, okay, those folks have been around for a long time, and there are still some of them. Are they going to be more hesitant to change that power than people who've only been here for a couple sessions? Because things go back and forth. You will someday have a Democratic legislature and a Republican governor. They'll happen someday. When? I don't know. So do you want to mess with these kind of powers? I mean, the partial veto authority is inherently tilts the balance of power in favor of the executive branch.
It does.
It's the way it's always been.
Right.
We've reined it in twice in the last 28, 29 years. Once, we knocked out the Vanna White veto, which was, you could just be able to do letters and numbers, individual ones. So can't can be turned into can, mm-hmm. stuff like that. That was done away with. The Frankenstein veto, where you stitch together two different sentences or more than two sentences, that was done away with. So, you know, I think somebody told me the other day that in theory, it's probably an easy sell to the public of you shouldn't be able to do this. In practice, what's the unintended consequence you have to deal with if they do something like
that? And it's interesting. The aide of the governor, Melissa Baldwin, called it a temper tantrum. These sore losers want to change the rules every time they don't get their way. But let's look at some of the context here. Republicans won on lame duck. They won on redistricting. Mm-hmm. So this would be another attempt by Republican legislators to clip the wings of governors, even though, as you say, they could regret this. It could come back to bite them.
Maybe. But, I mean, it's been a contentious relationship the entire time so far. There's nothing new with that.
Okay, new subject. In Tuesday's WisPolitics report, you reported on the governor's letter mm-hmm. to Mark Hogan, the CEO of Economic Development Corporation. And in that letter, the governor said, Foxconn plans now reflect a substantially smaller footprint, less capital investment, and fewer manufacturing workers. It is necessary to review the revised aspect of the project and evaluate how changes that can most fairly benefit both the company and the state. Now, this followed the governor's first visit to the mm-hmm. huge Foxconn construction site, and it also follows something he wrote, was it 2 months ago, J.R., when he wrote to Foxconn Chairman Gao, who's mm-hmm. now stepping aside and running to run a country, you first mentioned that we may have to change his contract. So I was very intrigued when you included this in your Tuesday report. Significant?
Maybe. It's kind of the governor laying down some more markers again about this whole deal. I mean, he says in it he wants to see the company be successful. He wants to see these things happen. He's talked about the size of the incentive package that was approved by his predecessor, Scott Walker, yeah. Republicans, that those folks who backed it justified at the time because of the size of the investment Foxconn would make. Well, now we don't know we're going to make that kind of investment. This kind of came the same time that CNBC aired an interview with Governor Evers from June 27, I think it was, which he said he thought that the company's going to hire about 1,500 people. Well, that's not that new. We've seen local media report that local officials have said they've heard from Foxconn about 1,500 toward the fourth quarter of 2020 when they're supposed to have production going. What's significant is the minimum jobs required to qualify yep. for tax incentives, job tax credits,
yep.
is about 1,800. The goal at the end of 2020 is around $25,000, I think, off the top of my head. So they fell short in the first year they could get tax credits for jobs of making that mark. We don't know about second year, which is this year. But in 2020, if they're at $1,500, they're not qualified for job credits yet.
Well, but I also think it's interesting because the governor, in his letter to Mark Hogan, said, you've been a darn good CEO of WEDIC. But this seems to say, Mark, before you leave in the fall, and that's not news, we discussed that before, get this renegotiated contract with Foxconn done. Fair summary?
Well, he's talking about how it could be beneficial to both the state and the company to look at this. I think he's, like I said, still putting markers down about where this thing is at because he's in this balancing act of wanting to see the jobs created, but also not wanting to see the state have a bad deal on the books. And he is still not convinced it's a good deal.
Okay. I'm going to introduce a subject here I'm calling unfinished business. Two items. First, medical marijuana. First, let's listen to the exchange over the last 10 days between Speaker Voss and Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald. Issue, should Wisconsin legalize medical, not recreational, medical marijuana? Please.
The entire discussion on my side of the aisle is very difficult because people see medical marijuana as a slippery slope toward recreational. I'd much rather figure out a way to get to yes than just instantly say, well, because it could lead to recreational marijuana, I'm an automatic no.
I don't support the idea right now, and I think I've got members that probably would fall into that same category, but I haven't really taken the temperature. I don't know that Speaker Voss has taken the temperature necessarily of his own caucus on that issue.
The governor, in his both his State of the State and budget message, reached for both medical marijuana and decriminalizing up to 25 grams.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and the Republicans said, Governor, you overreached. Now, in that segment, Speaker Voss said, I'm still going to try to find a way to cobble together some medical marijuana bill. But Majority Leader Fitzgerald said he should look at his own caucus. He may not have the votes. Now, you were talking about Voss has a history on this issue. So go back to what
I
he said.
I think even a couple of years ago in like end of the year interviews that, you know, leaders often do, Speaker Voss talked about medical marijuana as an alternative to opioids because we've had an opioid addiction problem in this state and this country, that there's an alternative to opioids. He'd be open to it if this was going to address part of that issue. But the dynamic has not changed between Speaker Voss and Senator Leader Fitzgerald, who at the time, I remember clearly in the news conference when we're in Fitzgerald's office and we said, well, this is what Voss said. He's like, he really said that? No, not going to happen. That has not changed at all. What has changed, though, is Voss now has an ally in the East Wing in Tony Evers, obviously because he pushed the idea in his budget along with decriminalization. I just don't get the impression, though, that the Senate Republican caucus is there. And we've told us before, Fitzgerald will not move a bill on the floor of the Senate unless he has the 17 votes need to pass from his caucus alone. If you put that bill on the floor of the Senate right now with a free vote, I've had people tell me they bet that you'd find 17 votes. But that's because you'd have Democrats all voting for it.
Yes.
And then X number of Republican senators. Fitzgerald will make sure if he can do this bill that he has 17 GOP votes. That's the way caucus leaders operate. They don't want to enable the minority. It's popular. We've seen Marquette University Law School polling.
And very emotional, yes.
Mm-hmm. So we've seen this before. But that's not going to sway Fitzgerald. And I don't think this issue, it's not one of those ones that, yeah, I think it's popular. But I don't get the impression, I'm talking to folks, that people are inspired to vote for or against somebody on this issue alone, other than a narrow band of like single-issue voters.
Okay, but the fact that Speaker Voss will not drop it leads me to ask you about this scenario. He finds some way to get support in his caucus with Democratic votes to pass it in the fall session, pass it through the Assembly, and then he tells all his supporters, I'm not your problem. Go see Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald. Is that a potential scenario, JR?
Possibly, but I just don't, unless there's a big momentum swing in his caucus, I just don't get the impression that he wants to put on the floor or he will put on the floor. And that hasn't changed in a couple of years. I'm not sure it would change in the next couple.
Okay. The next subject, unfinished business. I want to talk about water quality. There was a hearing in Sturtevant on the task force, but there was also some very emotional testimony at an earlier assembly task force on water quality that just a short segment showing how emotional the issue of water quality is in Wisconsin. Please.
Nutrient management plans at a time of conception in Wisconsin when they started being implemented never ever were intended to be used on facilities the size of CAFOs that we're seeing in the state of Wisconsin right now. When we look at where these large concentrated animal feeding operations are, there's water contamination. And we haven't bothered to update the standards in 12 years. We need to fix that.
The Wisconsin DNR made it abundantly clear that current Wisconsin laws are not intended to hold agricultural operations to the nitrate drinking water standard. At that hearing was a young woman who had two children under 5 years old and a baby that was going to be born in the next few months, and they couldn't go to their house and drink the water. And she was concerned about giving that little baby a bath.
A little history here. The governor in both the budget message says, this is a year of clean water. He put out a pretty ambitious agenda. In his veto message, he says the Republican legislature added $32 million to the purposes of clean water. It's not enough. But now you have all these other things. Mm-hmm. You have the Speaker's Task Force out there. You have the debate over whether laterals which connect homes to the municipal water systems in the city of Milwaukee, should the city of Milwaukee be helped when Green Bay didn't get any help, things like that. I still think this is an issue that there has to be some action in the fall session. Do you agree?
It's because, well, maybe not in the fall, but by the end of the session, yes, because they want to do something for the election next year, because there are so many layers to this issue. Northeastern Wisconsin, Kewaunee County, if I remember correctly,
yes.
All kinds of issues about concerns about confined animal feeding operations, CAFOs we call them, about if the manure is leaking into the groundwater. We saw the ads up in a state senate race last year with Andre Jacques about, you know, basically manure in the water and how this is dirty. We've got issues with PFAS. We've got issues with southwestern Wisconsin. And I mean,
nitrates, arsenic.
Cuts across party lines, geographic lines. So, yeah, I think they want to do something about it. The question is, what can you agree on and get done?
Well, also, some of the biggest problems, the biggest issues of contamination are in districts represented by Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to deal with this issue.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. The governor has been around the state signing bills. A new subject now.
Not many.
Well, okay. You keep score.
Okay.
But I want to talk about the scooter bill, which he went to Milwaukee to sign.
Yep.
Scooters are now legal if they weigh less than 100 pounds. They're exempt from having to register. Local governments can regulate operation and rental of scooters. They may be operated on most roadways, sidewalks, bicycles, lanes, and bicycle ways. This is a sticky issue in Milwaukee, isn't it?
I guess. Yeah. I don't know if I look good on one, so I probably... Or if I would fall. So I haven't got too much into it. But, you know, it's another mode of transportation. It's kind of this patchwork of regulations, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, kind of interesting.
Is it kind of like Segway? Do you remember when former Senator Roger Bresky got on a Segway and rode around the Capitol? Not a pretty sight. Okay. He also went, I think, to Janesville to sign the step therapy bill. This is a bill that passed unanimously, but JR, I don't have a handle on exactly what it does.
So step therapy is when you want a certain treatment, okay, and insurance requires you to do something else first. Like,
yeah.
You need to go step by step, i.e. step therapy, before you get this. It makes it easier to get your ultimate desired treatment, my shorthand explanation. But why I joked about the not many, I think we're less than 20 bills signed so far this session, including the budget. So it's been one of the least productive sessions that I've seen so far in years. Now, that's not a surprise, because you have a Democrat in the East Wing for the first time in 8 years in a Republican-controlled legislature. But even when you had Doyle and split control, they got some things done. I think part of the dynamic is that Republicans knocked out so many of their priorities in 8 years as Governor Walker. Toward the end, they're like on parochial issues that even Republicans can agree on. So now you're not seeing those bills being put in the floor or debated, because if they can't agree on them, they're not going to get Evers on board. So, and I think there are only a handful of bills left for them to act on. So it's going to be a fairly quiet year in terms of legislation.
Another bill he signed this week would allow cellular providers, to upgrade to 5G technology. Let's talk about the ability to use bill signings as a pretty effective PR, JR.
Yeah.
You go around the state. And by the way, he sent his cabinet secretaries to Green Bay to talk about the budget.
Green
on
Bay,
Monday.
Lacrosse, and Wausau?
Okay, a real roadshow here.
Mm-hmm.
So when you sign a bill, you can go wherever you want, usually quite often in the district of the sponsor, and score some PR points and get on the local TV media, right?
It is. And he talked about this during the bill signing of the budget last week, where he said, you know, people mock me as this hermit king, but I talk to people all the time, and I also get outside of the bubble of the dome, the Capitol, and get outstate to talk to people. And, you know, I gets calendars every month. He's doing something most days out, you know, somewhere, public event. But it's a way to get out and get your name out there, because it's just like, okay, look, we've got President Trump in Milwaukee on Friday.
Yep.
Look, the national media look at these events as free publicity from the state media for the president, because they see the president every day. They have a different focus than what we have, because it's a big deal when a president comes. I mean, it's for every president, right?
Right.
It's the same thing with a governor in a state, where we in Madison see him every day, or almost. They ask him questions, they have a different focus than the local media, which don't see him every day. It's a big deal when a governor comes to town. It's a front page story. Wausau, Stevens Point, La Crosse, Eau Claire. Just, that's the way it works.
Right. And I want to watch a video clip now of the governor at the bill signings. And at one of them, he was asked, why did you veto the provision added by the Senate that would exempt Tesla from the requirement that cars must be sold at dealerships? His answer, that was a payoff, the governor's term, not mine. Please.
This bill places some of the control back into the hands of health care providers and patients to decide the best drug treatment regimen for their medical condition. Healthcare should not be a privilege afforded only to the healthy and the wealthy. One of many earmarks, we tried to catch as many as we could, and it was an earmark, and frankly, it was a payoff to get a vote to get the budget passed. But most importantly, it was an earmark, and we decided that wasn't worth having in the budget.
Time for your stock reports. We're going to put up a picture of a certain Supreme Court justice. Why is this justice smiling?
Daniel Kelly. So we have not seen finance reports yet. They're due next week. However, Justice Kelly's campaign tells us he raised about $244,000. Now, I have not seen the final...
For an election that is April, 2020.
I have not seen the actual report to kind of go through the details. But I can tell you that for the past decade, that is the best July report for a Supreme Court candidate, other than two. One was Lisa Neubauer last year, one was Rebecca Dowlett the year before. The difference is Neubauer, who raised $358,000, put a $250,000 loan in her report. Dowlett raised $270,000, $200,000 from her own pocket. Kelly put no personal money in. So this is a good first report. Joe Karofsky, one of the two candidates who's gotten in besides
Dane County Judge.
She raised $121,000. Again, had not seen the report, but her campaign announced of that $15,000 her own money. So he more than doubled her up. Ed Falone, who is a Marquette law professor, not seen his report or an announcement yet from his campaign. But Kelly has got a good start financially. The question is, will it be enough? We've talked before, this dynamic of come April of 2020, he may be on the ballot at the same time as a presidential primary for Democrats. If that primary is going on, I don't know that all the money in the world is going to help him, because you just can't create that kind of enthusiasm for a Supreme Court candidate you can for a presidential race. Remember, this past spring, there was a surge for Brian Hagedorn of conservative enthusiasm. He got 606,000 votes. April of 2016, when you had Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton on the ballot, right, running for the presidential nomination for Democrats, the race was kind of not over, but it was really kind of Hillary had kind of like really put it out of reach. 1 million people showed up to vote. Now, 1.1 million showed up for Republicans. So my question is, if you're a Kelly backer, can you find a way to bridge that gap from 600,000 votes to 1 million and maybe more? Because if you have all however many running right now still active, it could be a big deal in Wisconsin.
Presidential primary, same date.
So that's his challenge. His challenge is the environment. Money's not going to be a problem. Environment's going to be a challenge for him.
Okay, give me the short answer. Nobody goes as deep into campaign finance reports as you at WisPolitics. Why?
It's fun. So you get to see who supports him and why.
Okay.
Like, I want to know with Daniel Kelly. So when he was appointed by Governor Walker to the bench, there was a perception that he was pushed by the Federalist Society and conservative law legal thinkers who wanted their own Justice Scalia. They wanted a Wisconsin version of Justice Scalia, a deep thinker on the bench. And in doing so, Walker passed over people who were better known politically, people like Mark Gundrum, who had run for office before, who'd won a campaign. Kelly's never on the ballot before. This is his first campaign. It's going to be a statewide race.
Okay.
You took a chance on him, so who's putting the money up to help him out? That's a big question.
Okay, next.
Rural Wisconsin. So since the governor's vetoes, I've seen this little narrative developing for Republicans of Governor Evers' vetoes hurt rural Wisconsin. And the answer is, or reality is, maybe. It depends on what Evers does post-vetoes. I'll give you an example. Kaukauna Lift Bridge, right? There was an earmark in the budget to put state money into fixing that thing. Evers vetoed the earmark, but said in his veto message, he's going to work with DOT and others to find a way to address that issue. There were trails washed out, and I think Juneau County and some of that neck of the woods. There's an earmark just for those trails. He said it's not right to say those trails get priority when there are statewide trails need to be addressed. DA positions, right? He vetoed a GOP plan for putting DA positions in various counties. That plan for Republicans created certainty for rural areas of the state, right? Evers created uncertainty in the near term, but in the long term, he could address that stuff and it would all go away.
And we also saw a press release from Republican Representative Shannon Zimmerman saying one of his vetoes on K-12 funding hurt districts like mine in western Wisconsin.
So it's something to watch. I mean, that's a long thing to watch, but if he doesn't address these things, you're going to have a narrative develop. And oh, by the way, in Brown County, they got two things to be angry about with Evers. One, he nixed an interchange in the expansion of 41. Now, if he eventually enumerates it anyway, goes away.
Right.
But two, he nixed the $5 million to replace the Green Bay prison. Now,
yep.
He kept the money
yep.
in the DOC budget, but he did not keep the authority to begin the land acquisition. So in Brown County, in the Green Bay market, he could have some issues unless those things are addressed later on.
Okay, falling.
Real quick, I saw a report from WPR that foreclosure rates in Wisconsin are at a nearly two-decade low. There were nearly 3,600 this year. Why is that happening? Because, rates are low, buy a house, stricter lending standards, and higher employment rates, more renters. So, never knew that before.
Yeah, but I'm going to rain on the parade because I read a Reuters story that's showing that our major banks are no longer having great problems. They're having great problems loaning to farmers in this farm economy. Yeah. So, okay. Okay, next week, campaign finance reports.
Yes, get to geek out a little bit.
Okay, numbers a lot, not mm-hmm. next week's Rewind. Okay, I'm Steve Walders.
I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for the week of July 8th.